It's time now for America in the Balance, brought to you by Oklahomans for Sovereignty and Free Enterprise. And now your co-hosts, Amanda Teagarden and James Parsons.
And welcome, freedom-loving Oklahomans, to another hour of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. I'm one of your hosts, Amanda Teagarden, in studio with, I almost said Ken Sellers. That's two years of seeing Ken Sellers, with James Parsons. Hello, James.
Hello.
And we are both with OK Safe. That's Oklahomans for Sovereignty and Free Enterprise. Our website is ok-safe.com. That's ok-safe.com. And James has his own blog site as an independent thinking person, and it is The Online Poop, and it's spelled just like you think it sounds, like it sounds. And today we're going to be talking about an issue that OK Safe has addressed several times, including bringing in the Freedom 21 people to give us a conference in August of 2009. And that's the issue of Sustainable Development Agenda 21, Smart Growth Policies, the Smart Code. Randy Bright's been our repeated guest, who is a local Oklahoma church architect who has written extensively on the issue of smart growth policies and how that affects church development, which has a negative impact on church development.
Right.
And
you got to understand that I come from Owosso,
Oklahoma.
Where we're in Owosso, Oklahoma, and we are still implementing some of those plans. And my church personally has been affected by some of the smart planning that has been going on. But that could be for a whole nother issue of what we've had to deal with at our church, and some of the added taxes, utility fees, and all that kind of thing that has happened in our church, and how we've had to completely change our way of ministry because of it. But that is it is running rampant. And what I like about our guest today is that this, again, it talks about issues in which no one even cares to even think about, unfortunately, and that is what is happening on your local city level, and how are they implementing these international rules at a local level. And we're all sitting here screaming about the federal government and how they're doing it, but man, it's really it's the inner details of what's happening on the county and in these cities that really, where you really get to see these internationalist ideas at play.
Well, that is correct. It is all politics are local, and these policies are being implemented at the local level. Our guest, as James gave us a hint, is Justin Padgett. And Justin, are you there?
I'm here.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being our guest today. Now, Justin Padgett is a regular citizen. He's not a politician. He's a realtor. He's a real estate broker in San Marcos, Texas, and he sent us a little bit of a bio on it, and this is an encouragement to regular folks to get engaged. It says his education background is in biology and chemistry from Texas State, and he took a green class to get certified in real estate and was deeply troubled when HUD and the National Association of Realtors was on board with Smart Growth, which is, as he's indicated, a.k.a. sustainable development, and realized that this was the infrastructure portion of Agenda 21. And he learned about that directly from the green certification class, which he was required to take. And the links were directly toward Agenda 21, which, for those in our listening audience who are unfamiliar with this, this is a United Nations policy. It is a global policy to control the activities of all humans on a global, right down to the local level. It results in a restriction of private property ownership, where you work, how you get there, what you drive, your transportation modes, the building materials, and as James said, your churches, how many parking spots you can have in the church. Every facet of human life
is your utilities,
everything. So Justin is fighting ICLEI and smart growth down in San Marcos. And welcome, Justin. And why don't you give us an update on what you're doing and what you found in San Marcos, Texas?
Well, thanks for having me. We're just being hammered here in San Marcos. I would never have thought by taking a green class that would have led me to the United Nations and Agenda 21. And there were some former council members that formed a nonprofit organization called Smart Growth. And I went to the meeting and I said, well, you may want to change the name Smart Growth, because that has some negative connotations towards Agenda 21. And then I read their mission statement, and it was directly out of Agenda 21. And some of these Smart Growth policies are going to be are being implemented right here in San Marcos with Smart Code, which is a stack and pack code that they're trying to implement here in San Marcos.
You actually have a place called Sustainable San Marcos. And is this the organization that was formed?
Well, that's one of the organizations, and the other one is Smart. It's actually called Smart Growth.
In any other words, like Smart Growth San Antonio, San Marcos?
Well, it's just Smart Growth San Marcos. It was a former mayor, a couple of city council members that got this group together, and it's to implement the sustainable policies here in San Marcos. It's a nonprofit.
It is. For our audience who have not been in college for a while, our listeners, explain what a green class is.
Well, it's a green class that talks about LEED, LEED certifications, all the sustainable policies. It talks about smart growth, which is new urbanization, re-urbanization of you know, downtown areas that are being dilapidated, really moving people from rural areas into more high-density areas downtown.
So it's just like Michael Shaw of Freedom Advocates in California calls them stack 'em and pack 'em type development.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's a classic example here. And actually, in you know, kind of, I thought it was crazy after I took this class and, you know, realized it was happening here locally. And I was so relieved, you know, to go onto the internet and, you know, discover that someone else had, you know, been talking about this. And it just allowed me an opportunity to plug in and start learning more about it.
So once you learned about it, what did you do?
Well, I started going to the the visioning process, just to, you know, I wanted to give my input, and I, you know, I found out that other people just, you know, they didn't like the code, you know. We want to let free markets work. We believe that the businesses downtown should, you know, find their way instead of having to restructure an entire code. So a lot of people were frustrated. And then you go to these visioning processes, and they already have predetermined outcomes. It doesn't matter how many people are against it. They're going to pass it. So,
hey, Justin, you keep using the word code. Can you give me some what specific things are you meaning by the word code?
It's specifically land development code for high-density developments.
Are there certain regulations that are in those codes?
Yeah, I mean, there are all sorts of regulations. They changed the code to Smart Code because I started educating people about smart growth, so now they're calling it Downtown Code. So they try to tweak things, and basically it's your land development code. When you go to your city and you look at your land development code, you have to go through the whole zoning, planning and zoning process. Well, this is a cookie cutter code that allows high-density developments to come and, you know, have stack and pack communities. And it's really tricky because the city council started talking about implementing this downtown code here in San Marcos, and I would ask them, well, does this still include any person that has 80 acres or more? Can they just automatically implement this code? Well, they're reluctant to say yes, but, you know, basically anybody that has 80 acres or more can adopt this code, and builders and can receive subsidies at some level if they have certain low-income housing developments integrated within those zones. Well, and then you have on the county level something working, which I thought was crazy when I first saw the map by Michael Kaufman, the Wildlands Project. You know, I started looking at the county level to see if we had any pressures on that end to depopulate the rural areas. And sure enough, we have a regional habitat conservation plan that the county is actively seeking to obtain 30,000 acres through environmental easement of people's private property. With our money, we won't be able to go on that land. And so they're seeking to obtain 7 to 8% of the remaining rural lands, which doesn't sound like much, but when you look at the map and realize you take out what's already been developed and what cannot be developed, you know, then you're looking at about 25% of the land that cannot be developed through, you know, through those environmental easements.
Right. Now, have you heard of Autumn Terrace? It's a little neighborhood, I guess, a housing development that's in the San Marcos. Have you heard of that development?
Which development?
Autumn Terrace.
Autumn Terrace. That doesn't ring a bell.
Okay, well, it says that here residents don't need cars to get around. Women get to push their babies and strollers to the market. Men pedal bicycles to work, and children run to school. Now, that sounds great. What would be the problem of that? What's wrong with all that?
Well, it sounds great, but it always sounds great. What about smart doesn't sound great?
Right.
Or sustainable, and they all sound great. The buzz terms are just wonderful, and that's a very calculated effort.
Right, and what I found in my city, when they write things like that, it usually means that there's one developer that got a plan, that got their water from the Water Resource Board straight over to them that they didn't have to pay for, that we, the taxpayers, had to pay for. Developer gets all the perks in which to grow there. And it's not just any developer. It's one particular developer that always seems to get those kind of perks and benefits. Is that kind of the same in-house politics that you see in San Marcos going on?
Yes, I mean, definitely. It's almost what I would call a public-private partnership with some of the tax breaks that these developers get. And, you know, the taxpayers are on the hook to, you know, for some of these breaks for these developers to come in. And it's to implement things we don't even approve of.
When you were describing the 80 acres and the conservation easements, I don't think people understand the problem with that is, but you were describing it, what they're doing is removing land from the rolls and forcing people into a smaller amount of land available, which will cause the price of land to skyrocket.
Exactly. And what they're doing is they're placing these environmental easements on the county, and you have two different things working. Some people pay attention to, you know, your local city councils. Some rarely pay attention to the county level, and then you have a whole regional council, you know, which is basically made up of unelected federal bureaucrats, which, you know, I see the big problem, but our county commissioners and our city council members serve on these boards, which we did not elect them to, those positions, and they have directors that, you know, get these orders to, you know, that we have to implement these high development zones or smart growth zones, and then they threaten to not give the municipalities or the counties their federal dollars. So basically, your city council and your county government, they're serving a higher bureaucracy instead of its constituents. And, you know, they threaten to not give the federal dollars back. But it's really disturbing looking at the environmental easements. Basically, what's going on is they're preventing, they're buying the development rights out from under these private property owners with incentives. And I'm sure your listeners have heard of cap and trade. It's basically a form of cap and trade. A third party holds these environmental easements, and developers can buy credits, sound familiar? Credits to develop in these high growth zones.
But they've acquired the land legislatively, not through offering money to the property owner, where the property owner can then benefit and make his own decision whether I'm going to sell that. And what they also have are agreements in these conservation easements that entail the prohibit in perpetuity development of the land by the landowner.
Exactly. And
so the landowner dies and wills his property to his offspring, and the offspring then is again prohibited from developing that land. So it is a capital killing, property rights killing move on the part of the first person that made the agreement to create the conservation easement.
Exactly. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, we've seen this before. They're land bankings. You probably have seen some of this move toward land banking also, where the cities or the municipalities or the state starts acquiring land for conservation purposes or environmental purposes, and then all of a sudden they've got all the land or a big chunk of it, and hence the term land banking. We're securing it and protecting it for future generations, but of course nobody gets to develop it. It's an interesting twist that you brought up, though, is that the developer can use this if they do certain things and can buy offset credits, then the land can be developed.
Well, exactly, but it's also just looking at it from a business perspective and not from the perspective of Agenda 21 or cap and trade, it's a really rotten deal for the taxpaying citizens. We pay full price for these environmental easements as if we were purchasing the land, the land and the mineral rights and the building rights, but basically we're purchasing these environmental easements at full price, and we cannot go on this land, we can't enjoy it, and we can't build on it. So we are buying air. We have no return on investment. We don't receive the land. We just receive a piece of paper.
Well, you're just supposed to enjoy the view shed. It looks nice. There's a tree. But you'll
enjoy looking at the trees while you try to cross a railroad track to save your life. But I mean, that's how. And I bet you that not every developer has an equal chance to buy those easements.
No. And it's, through this visioning process, it's amazing that you see the same developers at the county level being part of the vision team pushing the environmental easements. Then you see them at the Board of Realtors representing you at the city council level.
And they probably don't
promoting
even
the smart growth. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
And what we see here in Owosso is that these developers who don't even live in our city are sitting there making decisions on boards that affect my taxes. That in turn make me pay for the development that they are able to do. And this is the con game that continues to go on in all these cities, especially in mine. It is equivalent to the good old boy network, where you have these developers that are able to sit in these meetings and can dictate what who gets the easements, who can grow here, who can build here, what taxes can be used to do certain and they're not even representative of me. I mean, I can't even vote on these people. But there they are making those decisions, and again, I'm sure what you see, your utility bill starts to go up, your electric bill starts to go up, and you sit there and go, why is it all going up? Well, it's simply because these developers have this end game in which they are able to take money from us to pay for their little projects. Anyway, I can go on with that with all the battles I've had within my city, but I'm sure you're seeing the exact same thing.
Exactly. I mean, we've had full implementation of the smart meters. I mean, that's a whole other program, and how they can control, the energy that you receive. And I've been doing some research on that, and that's quite disturbing too. But it's most concerning, I think, that you have these regional groups. We see the biggest problem is the influence that's coming from these regional groups where the people have no representation, and then they're taught to set up these pseudo, consensus visioning groups that have predetermined outcomes, and many times the moderator is paid by our with our tax dollars to guide the visioning process in a predetermined way. So
right, and what's good for the region is good for San Marcos.
Exactly. So then, you know, it's all about the collective good of the region. And you know, thank goodness for these people to serve that really go in these positions that really feel that they're going to do us a lot of good. And I think most people have good intentions, but they get influenced by these regional planning boards with which they have no experience, and they're probably not qualified to make decisions at a regional level. I didn't elect my mayor to make decisions regionally for me. And it's almost like being in real estate. You can't represent both sides of the transaction, honestly, you know, if you're coming from two different angles. And my mayor can't represent our best interests as a city sometimes, thinking about the region collectively. So I view it as a big conflict of interest, and actually we introduced some legislation here to try to at least bring some attention to regional forms of government with proper representation, and the bill is actually introduced Friday, so we'll see what comes of that. But, we just need more accountability from our elected officials and continue to fight it at the local level and expose what's going on in these visioning processes and within the cities and counties.
Well, apparently you're going to become part of some sort of a region with San Antonio, city of San Marcos, Texas. And I'm looking at a document that was published in 2008, published from your city, you're in San Marcos, but this says San Antonio on it also. But City of San Marcos, Texas, Community Summit and Visioning Process, and they had 175 people participate in these visioning meetings. And, of course, these people are going to be representing all of San Marcos. Of course, not everybody in San Marcos realized that. And we've had these visioning processes here in Tulsa with Vision 2025. This visioning document says that it was an idea of what the dream was, the vision for San Marcos by 2014. So, of course, this is 2011. So they fulfilled the requirement to engage the public to make it look like this was public input. But the outcome is all the same. It's cookie cutter from city to city. All that changes are the zip codes and the names of the street. And what you will end up with are stack 'em and pack 'em development, more restrictions on land use, walkable communities, higher property taxes, and less representation because of a move toward regional governance. We've only got a couple of minutes till the bottom of the hour. So if people wanted to engage or contact you in San Marcos, how would they do that?
They're free to call me if they want to give me a phone ring, or they can email me. That would be great either way.
You want to give your number or an email address? Why don't you give an email address?
Okay. My email is Justin, J-U-S-T-I-N, Padgett, P-A-D-G-E-T-T, at Austin, A-U-S-T-I-N, .rrforroadrunner.com.
All right. Again, just one more time. Justin Padgett at
austin.rr.com.
Austin is in Austin, Texas?
Yes, ma'am.
And RR is Roadrunner?
Yes.
.com. All right. If people remember the words, then they'll put that in there. And, again, are you working with other groups, grassroots groups in your city?
We're working with, and this isn't a right or left issue either. We're working with a lot of different organizations, some of the Tea Parties, Texans for Accountable Government. John Bush has a great organization up in Austin. Terry Hall with TURF.
Texas TURF, yeah.
In San Antonio, she's been instrumental in stopping some of the
Trans-Texas
Corridor. Toll roads in the Trans-Texas Corridor.
Yeah, that's how we got started up here, was trying to fight that coming into Oklahoma. And
right.
So you are working with them. You are correct. It's not a left or right issue. It is a property right, a liberty issue. And once you get the people to understand that you're not against protecting God's green earth, but you are wanting to maintain liberty and the right of the individual.
And that you are not anti-growth. Because that's the other argument. Every time you start mentioning this kind of thing is, oh, you're just anti-growth. You don't want growth to happen. No, we want free enterprise to reign. That is what we're about.
Right, and the right of the person to own and develop their own property. Justin, we'll have to have you back again as our guest.
Oh, gosh.
Thank you for taking time, and we'll be talking.
Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. We'll have you back. And we're going to ask our audience to stick around for the second half of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio.
This is Bruce DeLay for Excel Firearms Training Center. You know, a life-threatening situation can occur without warning and force you to react quickly to protect yourself and your loved ones. How will you react in a stressful situation? Excel Firearms Training Center can provide you with the training you need to obtain your Arizona Concealed Carry Weapons Permit. Our four certified instructors have decades of professional firearm training experience, and they are fully licensed by the Arizona Department of Public Safety. Your course will begin with classroom training at our facility in Sierra Vista, followed by hands-on weapons training at our firing range near Tombstone. You'll get the 8 hours of concealed carry weapons training required before you can even apply for your concealed carry permit. To register for your class, contact Marty Hargraves at 678-0323. That's 678-0323. Or for just more information, call William Samadi at 458-8571. 458-8571. We'd like you to visit our website, that's superquality.com, for all the dates and schedules of classes. Excel Firearms Training Center, preparing you for the unthinkable.
Do you need to promote your business on the internet? The Truth in Focus Radio Network reaches listeners locally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and all across the United States. The shift is on from traditional media to internet marketing. Stay on the cutting edge with your business. Advertise with us today. Email radio at truthinfocus.org. You heard the word, so will they. Email us at radio at truthinfocus.org.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776. And the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I am Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee, Grant, and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders Fields and on the rock of Corregidor, on the bleak slopes of Korea, and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I am Independence Hall, the Monitor. I am the Merrimack. I'm big. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific. My arms reach out to embrace Hawaii and Alaska. 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia with his bread loaf under his arm. You can see Betsy Ross with her needle. You can see the lights of Christmas and hear the strains of Auld Lang Syne as the calendar turns again. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box, the roar of a crowd in a stadium, and the voice of a choir in a cathedral. I am an editorial in a newspaper, and I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Eli Whitney and Stephen Foster. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein, Billy Graham. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Longfellow, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
And welcome back to the second half of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. This is Amanda Teagarden in studios with James Parsons, and we just finished talking with the young man who's a real estate agent, shouldn't say young man, but a realtor in the city of San Marcos, Texas, who is fighting the implementation of smart growth policies and the adoption of the smart code. And if you're listening and you live in the San Marcos area, we would encourage you to get in touch with Justin Padgett at justinpadgett@austinrr.com. That's JustinPadgett at austinrr.com. RR stands for Roadrunner, so I guess that was his personal email address. And begin to network with him and other like-minded individuals who understand the dangers of green development and smart code and smart growth policies and what it will do to the rights of the individual and the prices of property and its availability in the city of San Marcos and the surrounding area. And we're going to continue now for the second half of this show to be talking about local Oklahoma legislation. The session started February 7th, 2011. We got off to a pretty rousing start when they failed their first test by not adopting open government policies for the rules. At the beginning of each session, each legislature adopts the rules by which they will conduct the legislative process, including their conduct, but how the bills will be processed. And the open government requirement said that all bills will get a hearing. Your bills are all introduced at the beginning of session, and they're distributed like a pack of cards to the committees. The committee chairman then read those bills in the committee. They have a committee vote, and it's either do pass, do not pass, pass with an amendment, or a substitute. You have those four options. Well, what's been happening, which they admit, is that the committee chairman is stopping a bill from ever getting a hearing, which means that the 38,000 people that that legislator represents back home aren't actually having representation.
Now, Amanda, why would they do that? I mean, why what is the benefit of not having a bill heard at all to the politician?
To the politician is one, maybe it's legitimate. It's a foolish bill, and he doesn't want to embarrass the author of the bill or waste time in the committee. That's a legitimate concern. The example that was given as a frivolous bill was one that would have required barbecue restaurants to have cloth napkins. What a waste of time. But this is also the same legislature that passed through a bill that recognized the Mexican long-tailed bat as the state bat. So frivolity is in the eye of the committee chairman and the legislators. The negative aspect of controlling the bills is that it controls which bills get a hearing, thereby supports an agenda rather than allowing the political process to work.
But is it also fair to say that it is a way in which a politician is able to campaign against certain aspects? And let's say, I don't know, a lesser government legislation. And let's say,
what do you mean lesser government?
Oh, let's just, well,
smaller government.
But let's say possibly open carry, let's say. Okay? And so it goes to a committee and it's never heard. Now that eliminates the pressure of the politician who went to campaign for open carry, never to even have to vote on it, so he can still say he's for it, but yet never had to vote against it.
And blame the committee chairman.
And blame, right, and then blame the committee chairman on that.
That is a scenario.
And that's what I really have an issue about it, about the whole thing.
Where they hide behind the committee chair.
Right. And which they openly admitted out on the House floor. You know, that's what the chairman's job is so you can hide behind me so you won't have to face your constituents on your vote. And that to me is beyond closed government. It is nearly not even allowing government to even speak for the people.
Well, the other thing, it was a way for, when we were listening to the debate, and you can listen to it, it's archived, and you can listen to the February 7th, 5 hours. You don't have to listen to all of it. You can fast forward to the key parts. The debate against open government starts at about hour two, just about right before hour three. And you can begin to listen to the arguments. And one legislator, it was Representative Don Arms, got up and spoke against allowing these bills to be heard because, as he was talking about, in essence, he was calling the yahoos back home or the yokels back in his district have an idea. And you all know the kind that I'm talking about. They meet you in the coffee shops and we have an idea. There ought to be a law. So to appease that constituent, you run a bill and then let the chairman do the dirty work of saying, I'm not going to hear the bill in committee. That's the scenario you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
The legislator's proper duty at that point in time was to sit down and have a cup of coffee and discuss principle, the principles of good governance, the ramifications of that idea that the citizen is presenting, and either persuade the citizen of this folly or be convinced, if it is a legitimate piece of legislation, that this is a good idea. That is where politics has come in and taken over rather than policy. And the likelihood of having a bill advanced becomes more important to a legislator than the principle that is presented in it, like a small government mm-hmm. bill to reduce the size of government. Those are the things that are being blocked when you allow a chairman who is not elected by the folks back home to be that chairman to determine which bills get heard and which ones don't. So the open government rule was presented. Quite contentious. The debates are interesting. You listen to it. Well, the House voted down the open government amendment to those rules, although they adopted the rules and they adopted some other amendments. Making some progress, but the progress and the amendments they adopted were only on the bills after they'd gone through the initial vetting process of being shut down by the committee chairman. So mm-hmm. it's at the tail end, not at the beginning. All right, well, that's the first week. The second week, then, comes a bill from the Senate, and it's a Senate Concurrent Resolution 4, SCR. And we're talking Oklahoma politics here, but sure the same thing's happening in your state. SCR 4, then, is presented to the floor on the House side. And this was, I believe, on Monday or Tuesday. No, it might have even been Wednesday of this week. And the floor has to debate it. It was Tuesday because I was up there. And I was in some legislator's office later on after the floor fight had sent. Did you hear what happened? I said, what happened? Well, they're talking about this bill, and it's a set of concurrent rules that would apply jointly. So it's a set of joint rules for both the House and the Senate. So now the House members had to examine these rules to see if they were worthy to where they stand on them, what the content of them was, what are we agreeing to, how are we going to conduct business. Well, it created a committee, a joint committee, through which appropriations bills would be submitted. And Representative Mike Reynolds submitted an amendment, as he should, and he said, surely this is just an oversight. We need to put this in here that's saying that those bills coming out of this joint committee, this new joint committee we're just creating, have to have 24-hour rule applied to those as well, so that they're not just thrown out to the floor and people who have no preparation, plus the public, don't have time to examine them.
Is it fair to say that these type of bills, these appropriation bills, are the ones that get thrown in the last week of session?
It is my understanding that these are the types of bills, all right? So now you got a joint committee. And I have to go back and read it so that I understand it more fully. But here it is. So what Mike Reynolds was asking for, a representative from my district around Oklahoma City, was to say, okay, I'm sure this is a mistake. We meant to put this in here that they have to have a 24-hour rule. Representative Dan Sullivan, of course, gets up and say, well, in these cases, you know, the house rules would have primacy over those joint rules if there's a question right here. Well, Mike said, well, let's just codify it. Let's just make sure that there's no... There was a fight on the floor, a debate, against implementing this simple thing that says these joint rule, whatever comes out of this joint committee, newly created, must have 24-hour requirement on it also. This is where you start to see the separation of who's understanding what's going on here and those who do not.
Right, and that's because at the, in the last week of session, things are just getting thrown at you from different directions on all these bills.
And it again goes back to the open government. If it has to be posted for 24 hours, right, it does give people the ability to look at it and examine it, both the public and the legislators. So, and that was the point. What happened was that the Speaker of the House called the vote after Dan Sullivan made the move to table the Reynolds Amendment. Tabling means you literally lay that amendment on the table and it cannot be brought up again. So now the vote on the floor is not whether to adopt Mike Reynolds' amendment, it is to table the amendment. So here's where it was interesting. The chairman then calls, he says, start the vote, start the voting machine. And that begins the time, the open time, by which and during which the members of the House will either cast a yay or a nay vote. Yay means we will table it, or nay, we will not. And that, he calls it twice, and he'll say, members, it's time you cast your vote or change your vote. And he gives you a warning. And these votes normally stay open roughly 2 minutes because sometimes they're in chambers and outside. But they give it a warning. It's 2 minutes. He held this thing open for almost 15 minutes.
15 minutes?
And you could watch the scoreboard. It's up on the video. You can see it goes 51 against tabling. It went all the way up. It was 51 against tabling.
Wow.
51 against tabling. Then it goes down to 50 against tabling.
So some whipping was going on. Is that what you're saying?
Well, 51, they didn't have the vote they wanted. The leadership wanted to kill this, to table this, right, amendment, and he held that vote open, which would normally have been 2 minutes, to almost 15. And the second it flipped to 51 yes to table it, he called the vote.
Wow.
Within a second. So, and you can watch, the screen is a little dark, but you can see the members being whipped, as it's called, going around there. And you can watch that score go for 51 against, or no's, 51 no,
and
50.
Switched.
You 50, 51, 50. You could see somebody was, they were working the weak ones, and I would like to have seen whose name was going back and forth, or if it was different people. And trying to, for the new people and those who have been there a while, to
can
find
you, can you give us kind of a background of what the what kind of goes on when that whipping? I mean, it sounds pretty bad.
Physical,
back there
it sounds
with,
physical.
It really
not,
does. But what's going on during that time when there's a whip?
Leadership.
What does leadership do to control a vote to go their way?
What happened? And I mean, this is a lesson in how the process works for everybody. If you're not familiar with this, is number one, you understand the tabling motion, and then number two, to watch the activity down on the chamber floor, where you can see the people who have been appointed to leadership positions, whether it's the floor leader, which is Dan Sullivan in this case. You have the assistant floor leader, the majority whip, the assistant whip, and those people, then their job is to go and talk to all the House members on the Republican side and persuade them to change their vote.
What is a persuade?
Listen, the leadership, you know, we understand, maybe you don't understand what's at stake here. We can't commit the other House to a 24-hour rule over in this chamber, or, and this is what happens, if you want your bill heard, you better switch your vote.
See, and that
can also take place. I'm not saying that happens 100% of the time.
But that game does get played.
It does get played. That card gets played.
Yes, and it's, I mean, when I hear legislators telling me about the whole whipping process, it angers me. When I hear the control that they have, and again, it goes back to the first vote. That's why certain bills get heard and don't get heard. If every bill got heard, the whipping process would diminish, or the power to whip these legislators
I think
would diminish a little
well,
bit.
Well, I don't agree. I think the whipping would still occur. However, what we would have is more transparency as a citizen because you'd have a recorded vote in the committee.
Right.
But I do think the whipping would still occur because they still go to the committee meeting.
It would occur, right.
Yeah. Now, your leadership is appointed. Some of them, by force this time, were told you're going to have the caucus, which is the members of either the Democrat caucus or the members that are elected as Democrats and those who are Republicans. And this battle between parties is out there. There is some, but mostly this is about power and control of the legislative process in a top-down manner. If people want to see that, you can go to okhouse.gov. That's okhouse.gov. And you can click on the video, House video, if you wanted to see this for yourselves. And the date that we're talking about, I believe, is February 14th. And just click on House video in the archive of the February 14th one. And it's a short one that particular day. It is, February 15th, excuse me. It's a 2 hours and 1 minute long video, but it goes quickly. And I tell you what, if you sat down with a bowl of popcorn and you watched that, it's like watching that vote flip back and forth. It's like a suspense novel.
For weird people like us who love politics, right?
So the 51 who are now identified through these two rules votes as being the sold out to the establishment would include, and I'm going to read the names real quick, is Arms, Bands, Billy, Blackwell, Casey, Cockcroft, Cootie, Cooksey, Cox, Denny, DeWitt, Enns, Farley, Grau, Hall, Hardin, Hickman, Holland, Jackson, Johnson, Jordan, Kirby, Liebman, Martin, Scott, Martin, Steve, McCullough, McDaniel, Randy, McNeil, Moore, Nelson, Nolan, Ortega, Osborne, Ombi, Peters, Peterson, Quinn, Richardson, Roberts, D, which is Dustin, Roberts, Sean, Russ, Sanders, Sears, Shannon, Sullivan, Thompson, Tibbs, Vaughn, Watson, Wright, and Mr. Speaker, Chris Steele.
Now, my question to you, Amanda, out of any of those names, is there anyone that surprises you or disappoints you at all?
The freshmen who campaigned in on limited government and open government are disappointed that they're not standing on principle. Representative Don Arms is a surprise, but he's been very revealing in his comments so far about what he thinks about the little people back home,
right.
And which is too bad because he's a pleasant person himself. J.D. Nolan, who is from House District 66 in Tulsa, of course, that was not a surprise. She was perceived as a weak candidate to begin with, coming from a school board. And so a lot of the other, these are all Republicans, by the way.
Right, they're all Republican, but it sounds like there's not really a name out there that really like, wow, we really thought you were on our side, but you have turned to another side.
It's usually the same
players.
No, they're just revealed as which side, where they stand. They stand with the establishment. Now, whether they can come around later on is up to them. You know, people can always repent, but it's a revealing. But on the other hand, we've made progress as far as grassroots and trying to get people in there on policy, not on politics, and it's half the House. That's a big improvement.
It is. That is the good news.
That's the good news. It is a big improvement. Now, on the other thing, why it's important to pay attention to local Oklahoma politics is because whatever the federal government does, the states implement. And one of those things, apparently, is one of these insurance exchanges. So you saw this, James.
In Oklahoma, in November, we passed opt out of Obamacare. I mean, it overwhelmingly passed. We had a governor that ran, hey, I am going to make sure we will fight against Obamacare. We had a candidate, Pruitt, who ran as an attorney general. I will make sure that we will fight for the sovereignty of Oklahoma and join the lawsuits. And we had all kinds of Republicans campaign, insurance commissioner that campaigned against Obamacare and implementing Obamacare. We're not going to do it. But once they get in the office, it's a totally different ball game, and it's almost mute is the word. But I just lost my train of thought. But one the biggest path into this Obamacare is what we call insurance exchanges, and it's basically gives approved insurances a place on a government website where they get to, you know, put their prices down and tell you what they'll offer and all that kind of thing. And then the government manages it and organizes it. And in order to get this all set up, you have to accept federal money from Obamacare to get this started. Now, here's the deal is we have a governor that has sat there and said, I'm fighting against Obamacare, but reports this week that she has accepted $54 million of federal dollars to set up these exchanges, which are in Obamacare. And she's not the only one. As far as we know from reports I've read, it's just not in Oklahoma, but all these Republican governors are setting up these state insurance exchanges.
Health insurance exchanges. And we found a document that explains it. And again, this is a new subject for us. We're not claiming to be experts on it, but James has brought this up. And this is a document from the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, Focus on Health Reform. And it's entitled Explaining Healthcare Reform, What Are Health Insurance Exchanges? And I'm reading here, a number of recent health care reform plans call for the creation of a health insurance, quote-unquote, exchange, a new entity intended to create a more organized and competitive market for health insurance by offering a choice of plans, established common rules regarding the offering and pricing of insurance, keep common rules for pricing, and providing information to help consumers better understand the options available to them. An exchange is part of the plan aiming for universal coverage currently being implemented in Massachusetts, where it is called the Connector. It was also featured in proposals from the major Democratic candidates for president, including Obama, in the Healthy Americans Act, sponsored by Senators Ron Wyden and Bob Bennett, where they are called health help agencies, and a white paper released by Senate Finance Committee Chair Max Baucus. In all of these plans, the exchange is a key element in providing coverage to the currently uninsured and in facilitating changes to the insurance market, particularly for those who buy insurance on their own. And it says, this brief explains the purpose and function of exchanges. And it's the purpose and function of an exchange. In the context of a health reform plan aiming for a substantial expansion in the number of people insured and universal access to affordable coverage, there are a number of functions envisioned for exchanges. And this is, and it goes on to explain portability of coverage, right, reforming the insurance market, etc. Well,
but here's the gist of it also, is that you're going to have all these private insurance companies, you know, in this exchange. But here's the catch, and this is always the catch: there is going to be one state-run program to compete against those other private ones. Here in Oklahoma, we have what is called Insure Oklahoma. Now, this is a subsidized state-run, mixed in with a public-private partnership that allows the consumer, which would be private businesses, to get insurances at a cheaper rate. Now this is where the unfair competition lies, and this is where it's going to – I mean, if you're a private business, which one are you going to choose? You're going to choose the government one, the Insure Oklahoma. They're the cheaper one. And ultimately, through what Republicans will call, you know, free market – It'll still have the consumer, which will be businesses and the individual, to choose the cheaper one, which will be the state-run healthcare. And the reason why it bothers me is that I hear all these Republicans sit there and scream states' rights, and when it gets down to the bare knuckle of it all, what they're really saying is states' rights means I don't want the federal government to do it. I want the power to do it here, and that is the disingenuousness of every Republican that's out there that screams states' rights and wants the same things implemented just on a state level and not on a national level. I mean, we're not – states' rights means sovereignty, freedom for each individual person. But the Republican Party, you know, and I don't mean to throw every Republican in there, but the establishment sit there and they'll say states' rights when actually they mean, you know, I just want to implement that on a more local level, on a state level.
Well, what this the description of this health exchange, health insurance exchange, there's some questions in here, and it says, how should an exchange be governed? And again, in this Kaiser document, it says, the functions of an exchange could be handled by a federal or state government agency. So this is government interference and control of otherwise what was the private sector, which is insurance. And it says, some advocates of exchanges, however, again, I'm reading, however, see the role of a purchaser is better served by a private or quasi-public entity that could operate in a more nimble way than government regulatory bodies are typically able to. Well, quasi-public entity means that, well, quasi means partially public and partially private. So it is the public-private partnership.
Right.
But the key part here is that it is government-run, government-regulated. And the funding always comes with strings. At the state, we found a bill. It is now Senate Bill 960, introduced by Senator Bill Brown of Broken Arrow. This is a new section of law not to be codified in the Oklahoma statutes reads as follows. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act includes an option for a state to create a health insurance exchange to facilitate the purchase of individual and small group health coverage and to provide assistance with enrollment of eligible individuals in qualified, here's the key word, qualified health plans in lieu of the federal government operating a health insurance exchange. The minute the state...
Yeah, give us the layman terms of qualified.
The ones that we say are qualified are the ones that are qualified. They will be government chosen and government approved. It is contrary to the free enterprise system.
Right, and that's what is chosen.
That's what's chosen, like quality jobs. Those are government sector jobs or entry-level jobs that they decide are qualified. Qualified is a term that will come with a definition in law. And if you are a private insurance company and some other people want to form a separate consortium, let's say, to offer an insurance coverage to a group of individuals, this, I believe, if I'm beginning to understand it, would prevent that.
Right.
Because you're not part of the state approved.
Right. And that's where the insurance commissioner becomes even more powerful, because they are the one that's going to regulate and manage who's qualified and who's not qualified. And so I go back and I ask, well, where is the insurance commissioner right now who campaigned against Obamacare? Where is he speaking out against these exchanges? And right now he's a Republican. He's being very quiet and there's nothing going out and there's no dissenting whatsoever. Where's Scott Pruitt, the one that campaigned against Obamacare? Where is he in this battle? Quiet. Cannot hear. Where's Mary Fallon, our great and lovely governor? Well, she's out there pushing it. She's using her platform, she's using her podium, and she's screaming from the mountaintops. This is the area in which we're going. And the Republicans all around her are quiet. And that is deathly, that scares me, you know, because here's all these people that campaigned against it. And as we and now in the back rooms, we're implementing it state by state, and it's just not our Republican governor. I mean, there are Republican governors all across this nation that are sitting back and accepting this federal money, while at the same time, we're going to fight against it. We're going to fight against it. And that is the type of politics that I just despise.
So we'll adopt Obamacare, but we'll call it something else.
We'll call it something else, and we'll implement it on a state level, and we will do anything that it says. But I mean, goodness, we get on to Mitt Romney for what he did in Massachusetts, but my goodness, we're doing it here, and we're implementing it here, and this is the worst thing: we're using federal dollars to do it. So the strings are only getting tighter and and bigger, and there's not one Republican who campaigned against it that is out there denouncing all this that's going on.
Well, it's a lesson is that you have to pay attention to what's going on. And we want to thank our guest, Justin Padgett, who was on for our first half. We'll have to have him back. And James, I can tell that this one's pushed your button, so we'll have to discuss this yes. again. Maybe we'll have Senator Bill Brown on to explain it. We want to thank you for listening to America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. May God bless you and stay engaged.